the best advice that you ever got, what would you say that is? And where did you get that advice from?
Okay. I got the advice from my father.
Uh-huh.
And what he said to me that during your life, there are times when you should keep your mouth shut and your ears open, because in that way you will never stop learning.
Wow. And how have you used this advice in business, for an example?
Look, I mean, quite clearly, I've tried to follow it. And, you know, what I find is that often if you're in discussions, you know, people don't really listen. They're already formulating their thoughts. And what I've tried to do is to genuinely listen, and it doesn't matter to whom. No matter how experienced you are, you know, you can always learn something if you really listen. And even at my age now, I find that very fulfilling because you learn, you never stop learning, and that's wonderful.
And would you say, having that as a philosophy, would you say that it gives you some kind of an advantage, for instance, in areas where you're going through negotiations in business?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Mm.
You know, I think the danger is when somebody talks, you don't really listen. You're already busy formulating your own thoughts without really listening to their thoughts.
That is true.
and that's a challenge, you know, and you have to physically and mentally attune yourself to that. I mean, often you would listen and listen very carefully, and what you would hear is sometimes absolute rubbish. Mm. But on many occasions, you actually will learn something from that conversation, whether it be trying to solve a problem in the business, whether it's just somebody who's got some unique and interesting thoughts. So, you know, that's probably the best advice I've ever had.
Wow, it's actually quite profound as I'm listening to you and just thinking about some of the points you're making. Just if we can stretch this a little bit, because I'm now thinking of certain situations where a lot of people could actually benefit from an advice like this. Here's the scenario, if I may expand further on this. You've got a more experienced business leader who's talking to a younger person, and their approach to the conversation is that, look, I've been doing this for a lot longer than you have, so I've got nothing to listen to you. You know, I know better. I know it all. And I'm sure you've seen situations where people think that they really have nothing to learn from somebody else. They should be the ones who are listened to.
That's
what's your comment on that?
Well, that's very wrong. If you're engaging as an experienced person with somebody of less experience, your challenge is to find out where they at. And what their view is on life, on business, etc., etc. Because unless you understand where they're coming from, you can't utilize your experience and knowledge in life to guide them. So what I'm really saying is it can never be a one-way conversation.
I'm with you.
And you know, and as you go through life, I keep saying to people, you know, when we started Coronation, you know, when the next generation of people join, you know, you can maybe tell them the history once or twice. You know, how we started, how we had nothing, and how it built. But after a while, you know, that sort of story gets a bit tired. They want to know where they at, where it's going now. You know, so you have to understand the context of where they at if you want to take them forward with you.
I'm hearing you. I know you just told me the story of Coronation, and you put a nice context to this discussion. Is there, over the years, of course, if you can't remember any, that's still okay, we'll proceed. But I'm just wondering if there is a particular scenario where, let's say you were in a particular meeting and you were coming out and you were walking away and thinking, you know, that I'm glad I was taught that by my father, because today I could see exactly how it applied. Is there one maybe story that comes to mind?
We were having discussions about in the business about we had some people in the business who did our technology, and they decided to leave.
Yes.
And we were having a discussion about replacing them. And then one of the guys said, "Why do you want to replace them?" And I kind of thought, well, where's he going with this? And I almost responded and I said, okay, tell me what you're thinking. And he said, well, why do we have to have our own technologists? There are many companies that provide the service in running networks and all of that. Why don't we just outsource it? And from being irritable to how can they make a statement like it, to very excited, because it put the business on a new path. That's one of the stories.
Yes. Wow.
You know, my initial reaction was, are you talking nonsense? How can we actually do without IT guys?
Yes.
And I kind of checked myself, because my first response was going to be, you're talking nonsense. Then I thought, no, wait a minute. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, get other people to do it for you. Outsource it. We don't need to employ the people. And that was, in many ways, a defining point in the organization.
Wow. Wow. Thank you. Thank you very much for that story. The next point that I want to touch on, and I like the fact that it's a pity that I'm not in Cape Town today to actually sit in one room with you, but I also appreciate this opportunity. I know that you're an entrepreneur. I mean, your background and the things you've done over the years, you've really done some amazing work. I mean, we spoke about Coronation just briefly just now. The question that I have for you, also from your entrepreneurial background as well as your business and in life in general, is a question of failure. And the particular question is, I just want to understand what your perspective is on this thing called failure, and how do you define it? How do you define it for yourself?
Look, I mean, in business and whatever you do, if you start off by thinking you're never going to make a mistake, you're probably delusional. And, you know, there are two things here. You're going to make mistakes. So my view is very clear. On the small stuff, you must have attention to detail and you must do them, because there's no excuse if you don't do them and do them well.
Mm.
On the bigger stuff, strategy, where we're going, you must accept managing money. You're not always going to make the right call.
Mm-hmm.
And you must just accept that. Your challenge is to understand that all you have to do is make more better calls than bad calls, because you're always going to make the odd bad one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, you know, failure. You know, if you that's failure, you will spiral downwards. So, you know, maybe I failed in this project. But there's a distinct difference between failing on something specific and the concept of failure. If you keep failing, or you don't learn the lessons of why you got it wrong, maybe you will become a failure. But if you fail at something, you understand why you failed, and you learn from it, you will never become a failure. And that's basically my philosophy.
Yes. So to expand further on this, especially I'm now 32 years old, for instance, and I And since I left employment in 2006, when I was working for Investec Asset Management, I've started a few companies, and I've been interacting a lot with fellow entrepreneurs who are also in their 20s and 30s, and you see a lot of despondency when things don't go well. For instance, two things I've noticed over the years is that you've got two types of people and how they react to failing on specific things. One person would say, this thing will never work, let's just give it up and never try again. And then you find other people who've probably tried about four or five times because they believe in what they believe in, and they just keep changing the strategy that they use to get to their end goal. How, in your case, has probably failing in some of the things you've attempted, how has it helped, how has the perspective you have, how has it helped you?
Well, firstly, if you failed at something, you should sit back and contemplate why it didn't work, and you should learn from it. It doesn't mean to say that if you fail once or even twice or even three times, that you by inherently are a failure. Mm. You know, business is not simple. Being an entrepreneur is not simple.
Mm.
So, you know, if you believe in your own ability, if one or two projects have failed, be ruthlessly in analyzing why that failed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had something to do with it, acknowledge it, and don't try and blame anybody else.
Yes.
But in that basis, you will learn from it. So the next one you tackle, you will be better prepared. You know, it's like playing sport. You know, if you're an athlete and you're running in a race and you get beaten, it doesn't mean to say you're never going to run again. You know, you say to yourself, why did I get beaten? Maybe I didn't train hard enough. Maybe my conditioning is wrong. Maybe I got a bad start. But I'm going to run again, and I'm going to run again, and I'm going to run again till I start winning some of my races. You don't give up athletics because you got beaten.
Thank you for that.
Quite clearly, you also got to decide within that whether you are better at 100 meters or 800 meters. You know, you've got to assess yourself.
So you need to know what your strengths and your weaknesses are.
Absolutely. And you know, you have to do that, because unless you do that, you will never develop. If every time something goes wrong, you find a million reasons why it went wrong, other than what you did, you probably will never develop.
I think that's such a powerful point you're making. I remember a few years ago when I left university and I was looking for work, going to interviews, one of the questions that they would ask would be a question of my strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
And I used to, whenever that question came up, I used to always want to focus only on my strengths and try to pretend that I didn't have weaknesses.
Yeah.
But now, since I started owning my own businesses, one of the things I've learned has been to actually know what my weaknesses are and actually be comfortable with those weaknesses so that I can get other people to help me in those areas. What's your take? Because I find that a lot of people out there, there are people, in fact, not a lot, but some people I've met who also want to pretend not to have weaknesses. What advice would you give? You know,
well, there's two things. I mean, let me use an analogy.
Yeah.
You know, if you're an alcoholic, and you don't accept that you're an alcoholic, you know, you're never going to cure it. And if you can't acknowledge what your weaknesses are, how are you ever going to develop those weak areas if you don't want to acknowledge you have them? And the second thing is, even if you've developed, if you're a business leader, you must understand very clearly what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are. Because if you or in a position to put people around you, you must put people around you that compensate for your weaknesses and complement your strengths. And you can't pick the right people if you're not prepared to actually understand what your weaknesses are. Let me tell you a story.
Yes.
One of my biggest weaknesses was I lost interest in things quite quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would be doing something and then I'd get bored and want to move on to the next one. And one of my mentors, when I started my career at the Old Mutual in the investment division, said to me, you know, Leon, what you must do is learn to focus. You are like a baboon in a mealy patch. You grab a mealy, take two bites, throw it away and move on to the next mealy.
Hmm.
So what you should do is learn to finish the mealy before you move on to the next one.
Hmm. Wow, that's quite powerful advice, man.
Eh? Yeah. He said, you're really like a baboon in a mealy patch.
And what did you think of that advice at the time when it was given to you?
I thought he was being ridiculous. And then I went and reflected on it. And, you know, after I cooled down a little bit, I actually realized that he made infinite sense. Because I realized then that, you know what, I get excited about something, it's a challenging thing, I'm halfway through it, I'm bored, I want to move on to the next thing. And, you know, which means you never finish properly what you start.
Wow, that is so important. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs that I know, there are actually quite a lot of entrepreneurs that I know who are like that, who move on very quickly before anything has had some kind of traction.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So how did you then develop yourself from your weak position of moving on too fast and losing interest? How did you manage to hold your focus and be able to achieve the things you've done over the years?
I mean, there were two things. I mean, I had to absolutely concentrate on those weak areas. And what I like doing is surrounding myself with people that could challenge me. Because if you don't, you don't develop either. You need to be with people that will challenge and challenge your good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very important.
Hmm. Wow. And then I'll move to the next question, which kind of ties in with this question of failure and weaknesses and strengths. And the question I have is also something that I know is a challenge for a lot of people. This thing called fear. You know, some people call it fear of failure, others fear, but generally fear that actually holds people back from taking action. What's your take on fear? And in particular, let me rephrase this question and say, in your own experience over the years, you know, throughout your career, have you had instances where you were about to undertake challenges, bigger projects, starting new companies, where you felt that you were overcome by fear? And if so, how did you handle and how did you behave, you know, under those circumstances?
Look, I have to be, once again, I want to use an analogy going back.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a rural community, and you know, as part of that, you learn to ride horses.
Yes.
And you're thrown off the horse. No matter how badly you are wounded, hurt, my father said, get back on the horse immediately. Because if you don't, you will be scared.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I have to be perfectly honest. In embarking on certain things, I don't think I've ever been fearful. I've been excited and etc. But the thought of being scared to do it never really crossed my mind.
Okay.
Because you shouldn't embark on anything starting off with the concept it might fail. You embark on it. If it happens to fail, you know, then something went wrong and maybe it's partly your fault, partly other faults. But if you want to start something, you know, you can't say to yourself, I don't know about this, it might fail. You start it. You think about it, you start it, and the outcome will be known. But you can't predispose it to say, well, I'm not going to do this. because I'm scared it'll fail. You know, because there's an old saying, the day you go meet your maker, you probably won't regret the things you did. Probably regret the things you didn't do.
Yeah, that's quite powerful. So I guess then you perhaps would suggest that...
And I have ever been accused of being over-optimistic.
And your response, what would be your response when those accusations are made?
Well, what I did is I put people together with me who were the opposite. So the whole story used to go at coronation. If you want to have the real news, take what Leon Kaempfer says and divide it by two, and take what Taste the Toy says and multiply it by three.
So you guys were basically the extremes.
Yes, and it's often good to have people in a team.
I guess it also boils back to knowing yourself, because I can see scenarios where other people don't want to be opposed. For an example, they want people to always be in agreement with their views.
Absolutely, and maybe this is a point to make. I always believe very strongly that you should surround yourself with a lot of smart people, sometimes even smarter than yourself, and that you should encourage, deliberately encourage vigorous debate and difference of opinion, provided it needs to be managed, as long as it's about the object and solving the problem and not about the subject and trying to score broad grounding points. Because if you don't encourage that sort of approach, you will always just have happiness club and everybody will just agree with what the boss says.
That is true, right? My next question to you, I kind of know where you are on this question that I'm gonna pose on you, but I want you to think about it now from another perspective. For instance, in the page that I sent you, I used the example of Raymond Ackerman, where it's well documented how he was fired from Checkers in 1966, and when things like that, it seems like a major setback in somebody's life. But now, looking back in 2012, after 42 years, you know, people admire him for the whole campaign story. In your own life, or in fact, even other stories that you can think of, or people that you know, including yourself, of course, have you experienced or observed situations where people were so negative about a situation that was taking place at the time it was happening, and then in retrospect, maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years later, they look back and they say, it was such a good thing that unfortunate incident, and I'm saying it in inverted commas, that unfortunate incident happened. Any
I know, it happened to us, to me and my colleagues.
Yes.
Before we started Coronation, we built up a very good team in those days at Cyphers.
Yes.
Managing money, and it was a separate company called Cyphers Managed Assets.
Mm-hmm.
And in the time we were there, which was about from 85 to 93, we were probably one of the most successful fund management teams in the country. We then went to Cyphers and we said, you know, we have a different philosophy to you. You know, we've been successful. We brought in a lot of assets to manage, and we want to approach remuneration in a different way. You know, you should give us profit share in the business we're running, and you can even cut our salaries. So that if we do very well, everybody does well. If we don't do well, we just have to try and live off whatever the new salary is. And we went through a lot of negotiation, and we were quite excited about it. And then, for whatever reason, in their wisdom, after having agreed to it, they reneged on the deal. And we were all very despondent, and we said, what now? And in actual fact, in retrospect, that was a very good thing that happened. because it forced us to make some serious decisions. And one of those decisions, we had a couple of choices. We could stay there, and we would have been unhappy because trust had been broken.
Yes.
We could go our own separate ways, or we could move as a team. After much debate, we decided on the latter, and that was when we walked out to form Coronation. And many years later, in retrospect, that was probably the best thing that happened to any one of us, collectively or individually.
Wow, that's a nice story. And what would you say is the lesson for other people from a story like that?
Well, the lesson is very simply, you know, if something really bad has happened to you and you're unhappy, you must decide, you must understand, if you believe in yourself, there are options. And then you clearly have to make some decisions. I stay where I am, or I have an option to do something else. And once you've made the decision on what your option is, it should never be half-hearted. You should commit yourself fully. Pretty much like Raymond Ackerman got fired and he decided he's going to build the most wonderful retailer in the world, in which he went out and did.
Yes.
You know, there are always options in life. As long as you think about them carefully, make your decision. And then if you've chosen a path, don't do it half-heartedly.
That's such profound and good advice. Thank you. My next question is on your perspective on leadership and the responsibilities and roles of a good leader.
Okay, let me preface it by saying that I think right now in the world we probably have too many politicians and too few statesmen, and we probably have too many managers and too few leaders. So what is a leader? I mean, a leader is not a manager. And I think the challenge of a good leader is some of the stuff we've already discussed. You know, if I'm a leader or define it as a CEO, there are a couple of very important things that you should consider. One is earned respect is far stronger than bestowed title. Secondly, your biggest job is an actual fact to make sure you employ the right people. Because if you employ the right people, the business will take care of itself. Thirdly, if you've got the right people, you must never micromanage. You manage the environment, not necessarily the people. And that later on will relate to one of the other questions you want to ask. So, and then as part of that, you know, basic philosophies in running a business is, you know, costs are real, revenue is but a dream, and under promise and over deliver.
Wow. These are such great points.
And, you know, the question of a leader goes to the next point. You know, if you surround yourself with a good team of people and you treat them like adult professionals, you know, my philosophy is people should do what I expect, not what I inspect.
Okay, wow.
So you manage the environment. The second thing is you've got to know your people. And, you know, I always said to them, it's a fine dividing line between money and other things. And I said to them, if money is your end game and the number of what you have is important in your life, you will always be unhappy. Because trust me, there's always going to be somebody with more than you. And if you really want to be humble, take what you have in rands and divide it into dollars and compare it to Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs. other side of the coin is if you're a professional, you do well what you do. You earn the respect of your colleagues, peers, clients. And money is a byproduct of that. And merely a means to an end, you will be a far happier person. And once you understand that philosophy, you can deal with other things in motivating a team to rally. Because money is a very, I mean, obviously it buys the groceries and stuff, but as a pure motivator, money cannot be the only one, and it probably is never in the long term.
I like this subject on money, because, you know, I'm going to say younger once again. I think for younger people, it is, when people look at the, for instance, when they look at the Forbes rich list, you know, and they look at all those figures, it's almost easy for people to think that that's all there is to it. And I think the more, and this has been my experience, talking to people like yourself, reading books, for instance, of Sam Walton, who, you know, and you realize
that Jack Welch, all of those,
Yes, and it becomes clearer that there's something bigger, you know, there's a much more emphasis on purpose than there is to the actual money that you have or that you earn.
Absolutely. I mean, quite clearly at various stages in your life, you know, if you're kind of just making ends meet, then money is quite important, you know, because it has to feed you and all of those good things. But even then, you know, within that little environment, it's not the most important thing, because if you're married, you have a wife or something like that, the relationship with that person is more important than the money, because you cope with it together. At a later stage in your life, when, if you've been lucky enough to be fairly successful at what you're doing, you know, money should be a byproduct of what you do and what you do well. You know, so I don't start a business to say I want to be the wealthiest guy in South Africa. I start a business to say I want to do this business, I want it to do well, and I want to fulfill myself and my people in doing it. Hopefully if we do it well, everybody will make some money.
Wow.
But if you compare that, you know, because there are many people where the end game is, I want to be the wealthiest person.
Yes.
Or I want to have 4 billion worth of assets.
Yes.
And if you do that, let me tell you, you're not going to be a very fulfilled person. Because you're setting yourself up to be unhappy. Because let me tell you what, if the world is like that, there's always going to be a couple of people with more than you.
That's true.
Or a lot more than you.
I hear exactly what you say, and it makes a lot of sense.
And you know, just on a philosophical note, you know, do I believe capitalism is the best system? Absolutely. Because communism, etc., has been a failure. But capitalism, as it has been over the last number of years up until 2008, 2009, which is capitalism, which I call cowboy capitalism, will not survive.
Okay.
If the capitalist system wants to survive, it should be capitalism with a conscience.
And would you mind to expand a little, because I like the point you just touched on and the distinction you made between the pre-2008 capitalism and what you believe should be the way forward. Would you mind expanding a little bit?
No, a little bit. You know, I'm the first to recognize that the capitalist system is a good system because it recognizes individual endeavor.
Yes.
But it must recognize it in the correct way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so let's go back to prior to 2008. Very much, it goes back as far as Enron. It was all about the money. So it had no sense of responsibility to community, to country, to business.
Yeah.
The bankers were trading. They were taking huge risks. They were being paid bonuses every 6 months.
Mm.
Then we'd leave the trading bank, go across the road and go do the same somewhere else with no thought to the consequences.
Mm.
And we saw what happened.
Yes.
Businesses, what one must also understand that businesses are also starting to realize that they have more stakeholders than just shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
So what's shareholder value? A business that maximizes profits or shoots the lights out for 6 months, but conducts business in such a way that it actually places a question mark about its surviving, or a business that is really well run, considers the community, considers the environment, and basically is something which will be sustainable.
Mm.
Now, I always choose the second one.
Yes. Okay, no, that's great. And I think one of the arguments, before I move to the next question, some managers would say, you know, the especially listed companies where they have to report quite regularly, some people may say that top leaders kind of feel that there's a lot of pressure from the shareholders to deliver in the short term. And your thought?
Absolutely, and I think that's wrong.
Mm.
And more and more it's starting to be recognized. You will be familiar with the fact Elias at the PIC was involved, John Oliphant from the GPF,
mm-hmm.
where we together with our people, we crafted the Code for Responsible Investing in South Africa, which says, sure, shareholders are an important stakeholder, but they're not the only stakeholder.
Mm.
And what shareholders should look at is doing good business is good business. And what I as a shareholder want to see, is I must look in the long term, is the way this thing operates sustainable.
Mm.
And that is real shareholder value.
Mm.
Not pushing for maximum profits in the next 6 months, and you do things which will jeopardize the future of the business.
Mm. Mm.
And I think more and more that's starting to flow through.
Oh, that's great. No, thank you. Thanks for that. I know that now I'm kind of wrapping up. I've got a couple of more questions, and I'm gonna release you maybe in the next 15 minutes or so.
Okay.
My question again is to you now on what is driving you at this point. I mean, given everything you've done, you know, you've done a lot, you know, within your lifetime, and right now, what is that one thing or those couple of things that really wake you up in the morning and say, I want to go out and still do this?
It's changed somewhat. From running a business, I now believe that I'm a passionate South African.
Mm-hmm.
And in my engagement and what I'm doing now, I believe firmly in this country.
Mm.
And what drives me, gets me up in the morning is to actually do things that are good for the country. And, you know, to say to business and government, you know, we're in this together, it should be a partnership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, business can't be passive bystanders. They need to work with government in promoting the good of the country and solving the things that are a problem. Government can't do it on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what gets me up in the morning and gets me excited.
Wow. That's quite profound. You've kind of answered the question, my next question, because we're just talking about people and surrounding yourself. We talked quite a bit about people. But there's just one thing I want to get from you, more as an advice once again to somebody else out there. When you surround yourself with people, everybody, when they come into the collective, they already have their own things that drive them individually. For instance, when people come to join your business, yes, they want to buy into the vision and work for you and help the company achieve its goals, but they've got their own things that are specific and very personal to them that are their own drivers. What would you say, from the perspective of a leader, how important is it then for leaders to understand those intrinsic drivers of their people, and how do you go about finding out what other things motivate your people as individuals?
Well, absolutely. If you don't recognize that, you're in trouble. Because a good team is made up of collectives, often of very different people.
Yes.
And you must understand that each one of those is an individual in their own right. And that they have nuances and things that drive them. And you must recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
And you must understand your people. Otherwise, you will never recognize them.
Mm.
And in the construct of your business, you must accommodate that up to a point. And why I say up to a point, if a driver in a certain person is very unique to that person, but is also debilitating for the team, they either have to modify that behavior or leave.
I see. Because I guess it's either they fit in or they don't. Maybe they'll have to go somewhere where they can fit in.
Absolutely. You will try for people to fit in by recognizing that they're all individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And you will have to accommodate that within your team and within your business structure. Because if you can't, you have a problem. But there will always be outliers where one or two of the issues that drive them are so ingrained in their DNA that it actually, they can't adapt, even if you recognize it, then it becomes debilitating.
I like the point where you say up to a point, because I think that's quite an important point to make.
Absolutely. Because if you just allow everybody to be what they are, and there's no parameters within it, you know, it becomes a bit of a bad fight, you know?
Thanks for that. As part of the book, the way I'm structuring this book, there's one section. I've broken this book into three parts. The first part is where everybody who's been interviewed will be quoted answering that question of what the best advice they ever got is. And then the middle section is where I'm going to be analyzing and listening and reading and looking for all those lessons that I'd like my readers to get when they read the book. And then the last section of the book is where I'm asking one question but focusing on three things. And I'm going to be quoting again, listing what people are saying word for word in terms of their advice in those areas. And this is the part that I'm going to ask you now. And I call this area Just One More Thing. And I've got three questions where I'm saying, what is the one thing? You know, after everything we've discussed, what do you think is the one thing that if could be applied or incorporated to what is being done, could make a difference, could add value, or could bring us closer to a solution? So that's basically the question. And the first point is the South African economy. In your view, and I mean, I know once again that there's no one bullet is going to solve all the problems, but what is the one thing in your view that you think if we could incorporate it in our current efforts, it could move us forward and make a difference?
Public-private partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
I'll come back to what I said earlier.
Okay.
We have a wonderful country and there's a lot of good things in our country. We also have a lot of problems. And, you know, you can't sit on two sides of the room and shout at one another.
Mm.
So, you know, all stakeholders must work together.
Mm-hmm.
And I say you can solve the problems of the country, maybe over time, maybe not all of them ever, but you can solve a lot of them if you genuinely believe in a public-private partnership.
Mm.
Business and government must work together.
I mean,
it's fundamental. We're all in the same boat.
And we need each other.
We need each other. So every now and then we can stop rowing, beat each other up, but when we're finished with it, we better stop rowing again and better make sure you're rowing in the same direction. Simple as that.
I like that analogy. Thank you. I'm starting to picture this kayak to where people are fighting it.
That's wonderful about South Africa. You know, we can call a spade a shovel, have our disagreements, but once they're over, we must understand we're in the same boat.
That is true. Thanks for that. And my next question then is on South Africa and Africa. In fact, if one looks at it, one would realize that this whole continent, I mean, I don't know what percentage, but I do know that a big part of Africa and a big part of South Africa is rural. And I think these rural areas are kind of, I would like to think that they are important in our planning.
Absolutely.
You know, what are your thoughts on what we can do to get the best out of our rural nature as the African continent, as well as South Africa?
Well, once again, I talk about partnerships.
Uh-huh.
It is the rural landed people and business. So you develop the rural areas in cooperative systems or almost a kibbutz type system.
Mm-hmm.
Where business can provide infrastructure for cold storage, marketing, all of those good things. The people work the land and they benefit from what comes off the land.
Mm-hmm.
They can't do it on their own. Business can't do it on their own.
Mm-hmm. I like that as well. That's great. And then my last one on the just one thing is on Africa, you know, and then if I may just lay the foundation a bit before we deal with this one. I was just looking at the history of the world, and we're just talking about the pre-98 and the post, sorry, pre-2008 and the post-2008 world. And I'm looking at the emerging markets, and I'm looking at the interest that that the world is now taking in emerging markets. And I'm looking at what Africa has to offer. And then again, I contrast that with where Africa has been, you know, because we've always had these resources. Now, the question that I have is, how do we do things differently as the African continent in terms of positioning ourselves as a value-adding partner in the global world in such a way that we also benefit and prosper going forward?
Once again, I mean, quite clearly, Africa is the focal point. Okay, let's go back. I mean, the Western countries, as we know them,
mm-hmm.
Europe, to a lesser extent, the States, you know, given what's happened, or probably, well, other than one or two exceptions, shall we call it fading powers?
Yes.
You know, the move is now, you know, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, etc., etc. The second thing is that because of that, South Africa's Africa's recognized as a major supplier of resources to the developing economies, particularly China and India.
Yeah.
I mean, they got busy building, I mean, every 2 years China has to build a city the size of New York.
Amazing. Wow.
So quite clearly, but what we have to be careful of as Africa is that we're not overtly recolonized. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So once again, I come to the maturity of Africa. A, they must learn to work together as a block.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Mm.
And secondly, the concept of partnership again.
Mm.
You know, does China want resource? Yes. But they're not just going to come here and strip the resource. Let's negotiate partnerships.
Mm.
We can get the resource here, we beneficiate here, we create jobs here, you take it back to China.
And
my whole philosophy is about partnerships. And often partnerships are difficult to form. But if both partners actually, one has something, the other one has something, and the one needs from the other one, whether they actually like each other or not, you can actually you can actually form a partnership based on mutual
interest,
on mutual need.
Mm.
So Africa has to learn to work together. I think South Africa can be the gateway to Africa. They must be mature.
Mm.
And then in the context of the rest of the world, must understand the need to not be colonized, but to form mutually beneficial partnerships.
Mm.
So my whole theme in life is about partnerships.
Yeah, no, I can see. And it makes a lot of sense. Because no one is an island, I guess.
No.
We all need each other.
Yeah, and what's the old saying? 50% of something big is better than 100% of nothing.
That is true. That is true. That is so true. Wow. I've really enjoyed this this chat. I guess my last question then is, you know, during our chat and even before when you were looking at some of the questions I sent you, and now during our conversation, if there is one question that you feel maybe you thought I was going to ask, or you feel I could have asked, or you feel could add value to this discussion, I'd like to give you the platform to maybe share your last thoughts on something that I may not have touched on that you think can add value to this discussion.
The importance of having, you add business, but you also have another part of your life, which is your family, and particularly your partner, your wife, or whatever.
Yes.
And I think you can apply, if you have a very good, strong bond and a good relationship, like I've been very fortunate to have with my wife, where you have a partner.
Yes.
It makes it that much easier to do the things you have to do, because your business and your private life is not entirely unrelated. You know, if you're down in the dumps and you've got a problem at home, you have to be a very good person not for it sometimes to spill over into your business life.
Now,
if you're fortunate, you know, if you've got a good strong bond and a partner, it makes what you're going to do that much easier.
I hear you. Wow, that's great. Those are great piece of advice. Because at times it's so easy to forget, you know, the people in our lives when all the focus is on the business and delivering results, etc.
And then there's another one. You know, you said, what's my best advice I can give to someone?
Yes.
You know, if they're reading this book. You know, I believe you as a person know yourself. Have ambition, because if you don't shoot for the stars, you'll never get to the top of the mountain.
So people must think big and dream big and take
believe
action.
In yourself.
Wow. Thank you so much, Mr. Kemp.
It's Leon. Thanks.
I really, really enjoyed. Thanks very much, Leon. I really enjoyed this chat, and it's been very insightful. This is one of the things I love about what I'm doing, is that I get to really ask these questions and hear all these profound answers and learn in the process. Because if I may just, before you go, just share with you where this whole passion for me started. It started when I worked for Investec for about 2 years in Cape Town. I was sitting on the dealing desk. Yes.
Okay.
And then I left in 2006. I started my first business in digital media. And by the end of our first year, things had gone so wrong that we lost a lot of money and we were in trouble. So that's when I said, maybe I need to go. Because everybody tells you that the statistics is that 80% of startups fail within the first 5 years. So I went and I asked people who have succeeded how they did it. And I think since then, and I wrote my book in 2008, since then, I've always been doing this. I've met with Raymond Ackerman, I've met Mark Lamberti, I've met a number of guys where I just go and ask to come for an hour and just pick their brain. And now I'm writing this book where I'm asking you and a couple of other people this very specific question.
I'm glad you're doing it. And it takes a lot of courage, and I wish you all the very best, and actually it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
And you have my contact details. If you ever don't, give us a call and come have a cup of coffee.
I'd love that. Thank you so much.
Okay,
have a great day, sir.
Thank you. Best of luck.
All righty. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.